Good morning, lads. How are you, Jerry and Owen?
You start the day with a good energy.
Good morning, Jerry and Owen. How are we doing, lads?
Yeah, good.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
Live every weekday morning from 7:30 on your smart speaker. Just ask Alexa to play OTB Sports Radio.
There's no f***ing filler.
Off the Ball. GAA.
It was not surprising to me that Donegal had earmarked this game, had a plan, and executed it to perfection.
Join in the obsession.
Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
A very good morning to you both, Kathleen and Nathan.
Good morning.
Two big smiley heads in here today.
I mean, this time last week, Ger told all the Arsenal fans out there that your club is desperate, it's in a bad state, it's been a season of underwhelming progress, no progress at all. You need to go back to the drawing board and stop reaching for those excuses about there being a young team at play here.
Where are you now, Ger Gilroy? Where? No, really. Where are you now?
Literally.
Where are you?
I've just woken up and I've been thrust into this position. Is there a title race? Are we allowed to say that this
is... You feel like there is. I feel like City are just going to be dominant for the next couple of weeks and Arsenal aren't.
No, I feel there is. I thought there was a total overreaction at the time to the defeat to Aston Villa. And all right, we're living in a Manchester City world where every draw, every defeat is an absolute sporting catastrophe, and somehow your bottle is questioned because of that, despite the fact it was a really good Aston Villa side that beat an Arsenal team who were on a relentless schedule of games and just didn't play particularly well. I think Arsenal have probably been the best team in the Premier League this year. I don't know if they have what it takes over the next four games, but suddenly it feels a lot more real. The way the fixture list has worked out, the fact they've had a couple of games before Manchester City, they're suddenly 4 points clear, and they've also four games left. They've got a far better goal difference. Now, City potentially could close that gap. It's hard to see Liverpool closing that gap, so an extra point. And I think if pretty much everything that has been asked of them this season, they've answered. Yes, they lost Aston Villa. In any other era, you would have been allowed to lose a game at this stage of the season. And we know what City can do. I always think back to, was it the night of the John Stones clearance when City beat Liverpool in that great game? I was on commentary with John Walters, and after the game, John Walters was saying, oh, it's going to be so tough. But this was January, remember? Mm. He's like, it's going to be so tough for Liverpool because, City will probably win every game between now and the end of the season. I was like, what are you on about? Like, there's no chance City are going to win every game between now and the end of the season, and City won every game. So, they can easily go and win, and they have the best fixture list with Arsenal, Spurs. What a game.
Yeah. Sunday.
Arsenal have to go to Old Trafford again. Much maybe like Liverpool tonight, you go, oh, tough game, but they should be have far too much for Manchester United. So you'd still have City favourites because it's in their control. They know how to go and do it. But I think right now Arsenal should be ending this season with their heads held very high.
Look, it definitely feels like it's going to be different to how last season concluded. And I think you throw in the Champions League participation in the quarterfinals as well. I've no question, in my mind, and I said this last week, that this has been a season of progress for Arsenal. With regards to the title race bit, I think it becomes a real conversation on Sunday if Arsenal have beaten Tottenham. And the Aston Villa result happened. I don't think it was something that surprised a whole pile of people, because when you analysed the run-ins 2 or 3 weeks ago, even before that Aston Villa game, even before the Crystal Palace game for Liverpool, if you picked the three teams, you would have picked Arsenal as a team with the toughest run-in. And when you have the toughest run-in, a fixture like Aston Villa comes along and you get nothing from it. But Tottenham is also one of these fixtures. So if they've come away from Aston Villa, from Chelsea, from Tottenham, from the trip to Molineux and got 9 points out of a possible 12, I think that's an okay return. And I think that if they find themselves in a situation where it's properly on, I think they go to Old Trafford and they win, and you're just banking on Tottenham then to take points off Manchester City. So I think it becomes real after Sunday, but Tottenham caused Arsenal problems in the first half of the season at the Emirates, and I think there's also the ceiling that Tottenham have obviously shown this season has been extraordinary, so they can cause any team problems.
I also don't think United is as clear-cut as you do. Like we haven't beaten them in Old Trafford in the league in several years, and I think that they're sort of a bogey team for Arsenal. They've been really high-scoring games the last couple of years for both sides. It's either been 3-1-1 or 3-2, and I just wouldn't be totally confident. If we get over the North London derby at the weekend, I think it's definitely a good sign, but I would still be hesitant until after the United game to get my hopes up, because I also think that's the sort of game that United can get themselves up for and say, well, we can stop Arsenal's title run and invoke the ghosts of past, and that would be good enough for them rather than what they actually want to do themselves in the league.
It also happens before the Tottenham-Manchester City game. So the Tottenham-Manchester City game is like the second last game of the season. It's in that midweek slot, the 14th of May, 5 days before the final day of the season. And I think when you get down to the final day of the season, it's Manchester City at home to West Ham, so all hope will be lost.
It's always Manchester City home to West Ham and Liverpool home to Wolves on the final day of the season, it feels like. City's fixture list is obviously far more favourable. They go to Brighton. They're in the same spot that Arsenal were in last night against Chelsea. And, you know, Chelsea are obviously a shambles in lots of ways, but they're also a mid-table team with nothing to play for. The same way Brighton are, the same way Wolves are, the same way Fulham are, all of whom Manchester City play. They'll probably win this 5-0 and they'll be laughed out of town. But like Forest away next Sunday might actually be one of their more difficult games, because Forest are fighting for something and obviously are itching for a fight with anybody who will take one at the moment. Nottingham Forest are actually quite a good counter-attacking team. Now, I'm not going to sit here and predict. I'll wait till who you got to try and make my late catch-up at the end of the season and say that Forest are going to beat City, but that might actually be one of their tougher games. But Haaland and Foden weren't involved in training yesterday. Maybe that, again, gives a glimmer of hope to Brighton.
I'd be astonished if Brighton got anything off Manchester City. No, it's so bad.
There's very little to suggest that Brighton are just suddenly going to come up with something. I love giving this guy awards, so I'm going to give him another one. Declan Rice, player of the season. There's no question.
Probably is, isn't he?
Like, Phil Foden might be the best player in the Premier League, but Declan Rice has been the most influential player in the Premier League this season. He was bloody brilliant again last night. Like, what he has brought in terms of, obviously, footballing ability, but it just feels like character to that Arsenal side, the way he consistently drives them forward, and his football has got better and better. His passing, his ability to get more box to box, to be involved in and around the edge of the area, has probably freed Odegaard up a little bit more as well. One of the great Arsenal signings,
the best since, well, I said early in the season that it was the best since Van Persie. I wonder at what stage does he eclipse that. It'll take a couple of more seasons probably, and also not betraying Arsenal.
Well,
moving to
you win a title, and I think you're straight past Robin.
Exactly, but again, the probability is that he's not going to do this that this season. So
allow yourself to dream.
Oh, 100%. But like,
you don't have to bring your Yerraism to football as well.
It's absolutely. You see, I think you confuse Yerraism for the cold reality of what being a sports fan sometimes is. And if you shield yourself from...
You tell me about crushing disappointment, Owen.
But I'm just telling you, my coping mechanism is shielding myself from ultimate disappointment by not allowing myself to dream of the opposite.
Well, I'm surprised you're more positive than I expected you to be at this stage. Like, normally, when we're talking about this, I'm the more positive one, whereas I feel that you're a bit more like, yeah, we can go get a result against Spurs, we can get a result against United.
I just think that that Tottenham team is a bit of a random team.
And no Doggy, no Porro potentially.
Does it really matter? You're not going to keep a clean. They're not going to keep a clean sheet anyway. Like, I know when you talk about those two players, you're probably talking about their attacking potential as much as anything else. But like, there's a world where Tottenham beat Manchester City 4-3. I'd never ever thought that Tottenham would beat Manchester City 1-0. And the same goes for this Sunday. Arsenal probably need to. It'll be kind of a roller coaster of a situation this Sunday, and you hope that Arsenal, for the sake of the title race, come out of it winning by the odd goal after a 5-7 goal thriller, whatever it may be. And the same thing happens to Manchester City and they come out the wrong side of it. So it's just they're a chaotic team. They have the keys to the title race. They will want Arsenal to not win the title. And it's just going to be a very fun conclusion, because they're the ones that have to play all three teams. So that's the title race.
You're really putting it up to Tottenham. And
yeah.
Professionalism.
But also the history that Tottenham have in Manchester
City. Are you saying that Youngman's son could go out onto a pitch being unprofessional? That he'd care more about beating Arsenal than he will about the games against Liverpool and Manchester City?
I'm saying that they'll care about all three, but...
What are you saying about Richarlison?
Arsenal are first up. What am I saying about Richarlison? Like, it's... It should be a fun conclusion to the season, is all I'm saying.
There's obviously going to be a difference for Spurs playing Arsenal compared to City or Liverpool.
And these are professionals. They've got to approach each game with the same mindset, surely.
There'd be no fun in that, though.
They're at home this weekend as well, Tottenham.
Yeah.
Where they have to go to Anfield.
Yeah, it is a very different prospect, to be fair, for Tottenham. They are at home to Manchester City as well, by the way. I'm just saying, this Sunday, if Arsenal get 3 points, then I think it's back on. So we're in this kind of middle zone at the moment. Speaking of teams that would love to get one over their local rivals and to crush their dreams tonight, Everton versus Liverpool. It's got to be. Is there any concerns about what Liverpool might suffer here tonight?
I think when Liverpool supporters look at the fixture list again, you obviously look at the Tottenham game, and then you go, "Ooh, Everton, Merseyside derby." It's not exactly playing a team fifth from bottom. I know it's showing a little sign of life over the last few weeks. There's a worry because it's a derby in the sense that anything can happen. Generally, only one thing has happened in Merseyside derbies, which is Liverpool win. It's what, one win for Everton in the past 13 seasons in the Merseyside derby? And I think that might have been...
Is that Ancelotti?
Even during COVID in 2021.
Right.
So you would have to think that Liverpool go there. It might even suit them that Everton have picked up a few points over the last few weeks that they can relax a bit. But like Diogo Jota's out again for a fortnight, like a fortnight at this stage, could it be the end of your season? Their inability to keep him fit may well prove to be the difference in the title race. And the just that little bit of rootlessness and cutting edge that he seems to have, that Diaz and Nunez in particular. Now, Salah was dropped / rested, so he'll surely come back in, has a sensational record against Everton. You expect Nunez will probably come back in as well in place of Jota. And as I say, I think if you look at the history books, generally Liverpool win the derby under Klopp.
And it's his last derby, obviously. I mean, the talk this week has shifted interestingly on the Liverpool managerial front. Like, if Michael Edwards hadn't come back to Liverpool, would you be more concerned than you would be now? Because definitely my first read of it is when you see someone like Arne Slot connected to the job, you think to yourself, right, okay, there's been a lot of research gone into this, and they clearly have decided that Amorim is not the right guy for this group of players, as opposed to judging him solely on reputation. And you're very intrigued about what they're seeing in Slot, and it must be the right call. But is that just my opinion, because Liverpool have tended to recruit relatively well over the best part of the last decade?
Well, what about Ruben Amorim, who a month ago is at the centre of a tug of war between Liverpool and Barcelona, and where will he decide to go this summer? And now it's
West Ham.
Not quite sure if West Ham is for me. Unfortunately, things haven't worked out the way Ruben might have wanted over the last while. I think what's probably happened is, in line with what we've seen from Liverpool, even during the first Michael Edwards spell and in between, whereas they keep their cards very close to their chest, which means there's a lot of probably unfounded and ill-informed speculation as to what they would probably do based on who the best managers are around Europe, who might bring something a little bit different. Like, it's the same manager has basically been linked with Barcelona, Bayern Munich and Liverpool all of the time. Whether it's De Zerbi last weekend, potentially in Munich and talking to them. There's talk of Slot potentially being of interest to Barcelona as well as a successor to Xavi. You know, he seems to come with the most similar style of play to Klopp, a very high intensity. Don't know if it'll be quite be rock and roll football, but whereas you would have looked at a De Zerbi who plays quite a different, more possession-based style of play that may not suit the players, but I'm not sure if, does that matter? Do you want a manager who comes in and plays the exact same way? Because like whoever comes in has to somehow try and be their own person, and like the pressure on them, firstly on the footballing point of view, but also on the other side to have a connection with the fans, which you're just never going to do. Like, there's few people in the world that you've seen who have that sort of charisma that Klopp has and the magnetism that he has. So you just need somebody who can put together a really good team. Obviously, Feyenoord won the league last year. They're not going to win it this year. They had a good run in Europe. It's a tough bloody gig for whoever gets it. And all of them are unproven in a way at a club of that size, with the expectation that comes now that you have to be both a short-term and a long-term success. So it's all very well coming in and building, and everyone will say when we're talking about it the day after, well, nobody can expect instant success. Oh, except the Liverpool supporters are going to expect instant success. Like, they're going to expect them to be contending again next season, regardless of who comes in, and should do, because actually Klopp is probably a little bit ahead of where they thought they would be this season. Like, Szoboszlai should get better. McAllister should get better. Kanata should get better. Darwin Nunez might even get better. So that's the bit that I think a lot of modern managers, Pochettino, for example, are struggling with at the moment, that Now, Pochettino's probably a very good long-term option for Chelsea, but actually what they need now is somebody to just shake them up and get them winning games very quickly.
Do you still think Pochettino's a good long-term bid for Chelsea?
Right now, I think he would have been if... At any other club, I think he'd be a good long-term fit. I think he's good at building something. Maybe he's not, in modern football, the right manager for... Chelsea are a top 10 team at this stage, but a team with insane expectations that he needs to come in, that he might have been a good manager for a Villa, where you can come in, ground up, start making your own signings, get the players you want. Like, you look at that Chelsea team again last night, and firstly trying to predict it. They went through a nice spell, actually, where they had a bit of form where it looked like they sort of settled 11, but now you're questioning the ability of every one of them, you're questioning the character of every one of them, you're watching Raheem Sterling coming on and looking at him and just going, what have you done with your career over the last couple of years? Yeah, you've probably made an absolute fortune, but like Conor Gallagher's meant to be in the England squad for the European Championship. I watched him last night against... Not much there. Really not much there. So I have no idea if Arne Slot's going to be a good Liverpool manager. Like, who would you give it to right now?
Well, I was saying yesterday, it's probably the worst job in football to take right now, in the sense that you're having to come in after Klopp. And if you're an aspiring manager, would you really want it? You might want it in like a season's time when someone's come in, possibly not lived up to any expectations, and then you can come in and actually put your own stamp on it. But almost this is a stage where you need, like, I don't want to say the dreaded word, but an interim manager or someone just to take a little bit of the heat off for 6 months to a year, and then bring in someone that can wipe the slate clean and start afresh and not come in straight after Klopp.
Or you don't. And actually, it's not Manchester United 2013. There's a good group of players there. As I said, I think you're right. Like, the bit of, like, they win their first match and they score in the last minute to win it at Anfield in front of the Kop. What does the new Liverpool manager do? Does he politely applaud the supporters? Does he have to go down and give them the three fist pumps Klopp style? If he doesn't interact with them in the right way, is there a, oh, it's not like it used to be. And that part, I think, is big. But I do just wonder, on a football side, if you get a good manager who comes in and wins games pretty quickly and gets them in a title race, that, you know, do we reflect on the Klopp era at the end of it differently? And, oh, maybe they could have achieved more over the last couple of years.
Do you think the new manager is going to have Mo Salah?
I'd say the new manager will want to keep Mo Salah.
There's a fair bit in the papers this morning that he's not going to be there past the end.
Like, is the Saudi money going to be the same during the summer?
As it was last year.
Well, you'd have to imagine a year on, a year older. But he does seem to be the most valuable player in the world for Saudi football right now. So, you know, do they still manage to get can they get 100 million from? In which case, it gives your new manager a bit of cash to... I don't even think they need a rebuild. They probably only need
a replacement for Salah if he goes.
Somebody out on that right-hand side. You know, Harvey Elliott looks like he could be that, but it's a lot of pressure on a very young player. But, you know, it certainly gives you a nice little bit of cash to go and spend.
Klopp's kind of done the rebuild for you, and the midfield in particular, the reconstitution of that over the course of last summer and how well they've been at times this season. I think it's on that element alone, it's quite an attractive job to take, but completely accept the point that it's quite daunting to follow up what's been one of the greatest managers in the club's history. Plenty of reaction to last night. First of all, Bobby Dwyer, a Tottenham fan, has said that he'd be happy for Spurs to roll over against Manchester City on the second last day of the season, which is, petty, but beautifully petty. It's what we like to see from our football
fans. I want a camera on own the night of that game. That there's nothing quite like the frustration of it being out of your hands and the team that you're relying on. Just not when City are 2-0 up after 8 minutes.
Tommy says, imagine if Ten Hag lost 5-0 last night. The media will be all over it, wanting him sacked. Not a word about Poch losing his job. Only give him time to work with the young players.
Yeah, but you can't claim on one hand to be the biggest club in the world and then constantly get annoyed when people talk about your club after every single game. Like, people care more about Manchester United and are more interested in Manchester United than they are Chelsea. Everyone accepts Chelsea as a complete basket case. Mm. Everyone looks at what they did last summer and thought at the time it was absolute insanity. There's a likability factor for Ten Hag for Pochettino, probably because of what he did before, and maybe a more respect for what he did, rightly or wrongly, at Ajax or at Tottenham. I'm getting confused between two of them completely now. Well, God damn you, Tommy.
he's had a word with people like you Nathan. It's on the back of the Irish Daily Star and other papers this morning. You're all a disgrace. Terry Ten Hag coming out after their, well, not after the game. No, it was after the game, wasn't it? He said he's branded his critics, not his side, a disgrace following Manchester United's FA Cup semi-final near implosion. So I think, yeah, he's done a press conference since the last day and he was asked about Roy Keane saying that they were almost embarrassed to win at the end. And he claims that there should be nothing embarrassing about this Manchester United team. You're the embarrassing ones. Talking to the likes of Roy Keane and Jamie Carragher, I think, was particularly critical after the game on Sunday as well. But yeah, you're right, there is a higher expectation on Manchester United. I do, however, dispute the fact that Poch is getting a free pass. I think because of how we know how Chelsea operate over the past 10 years or so, granted they've got, it's not the Abramovich trigger-happy era anymore, but if there was a headline that came out tomorrow being like Mauricio Pochettino sacked, what would your reaction be? Be like, oh,
shrug of the shoulders.
Yeah.
Like, we all know it's going to happen.
Yes.
Someday.
So it just doesn't feel like as big a story as the future of Ten Hag.
It feels like Poch has had such a disappointing progression since the Spurs days.
Ugh.
Like
one of the most like highly potential managers that we've seen come through, and it's just been a bit ugh since then.
Like when people now say that he's overrated, or that his, maybe when it comes to his managerial greatness, it was never at the very, very top level. He did very well to take a Tottenham team to a Champions League final. But beyond that, you know, what have you done? I didn't have a lot of sympathy.
What more can you do?
I didn't have a lot of sympathy for
consistently
that.
Consistently got
opinion.
Them into the Champions League, but played really good football, built a top-class team. When you look at that side of Kane, Son, Ali, Eriksen, like when they had Walker and Rose at full back, Hugo Lloris at his peak, two Belgian centre-backs, Dembele in midfield. They were a bloody good team.
Yeah, they were.
Who were, for probably what their wage bill was compared to the sides around them, you know, it's definitely competing above themselves. Whereas now it couldn't be more the reverse with where you look at what Chelsea. But that has never looked like a, how many of those players did he, and I know how many players do any of them sign, but obviously the difference in criticism would probably be that the signings that Erik ten Hag would have been seen to have been making, you know, haven't succeeded, whereas Poch probably is given a bit of a free pass in some way of, well, this isn't his team. This is just a group of players that have been landed upon him. And as a coach, he should be able to make the best of it. You know, I think a few weeks ago, it looked like he was starting to maybe get somewhere. But, you know, if Cole Palmer isn't there, it's, you know.
He seems a bit exasperated by all of them at the moment and just a bit fed up in general. Like, it feel, whenever he talks about it, it sounds like he's herding cattle rather than trying to build a football team. But also, he knew that's the situation that he was going into when he signed up to Chelsea. It's not that it was an unknown thing that Bowley had been a bit ridiculous with his spending and that it was a basket case of a team that he was taking over. So is there maybe a slight responsibility there on his side to get over it and realise that he has to deal with the hand he's signed up for?
Absolutely. Like, the manager will always have to take responsibility, and there is that bit of, like, is there a manager who can come in and make Enzo Fernandez look like, you know, the most expensive midfielder? Is there one who can bring Moises Caicedo and get him back to where he was at Brighton? Or was it just the right manager at the right place, the perfect system for him, the pace at which they played? Whereas it doesn't feel as though Spurs have had any sort of system. Like, when he came in first and you looked at the signings, you thought, well, this, again, go back to that Tottenham thing, fits in perfect. So it's sort of 4-2-3-1 where Fernandes and Caicedo are in there. Like, the two of them again last night looked completely, completely lost. Like, that was, you know, Odegaard and Rice just did whatever the hell they wanted for the entire game. So I don't know, I think with Poch there is that sense of it's Chelsea.
It's interesting, like, he's got a lower win percentage than Frank Lampard did in his first stint, a significantly lower win percentage obviously than the likes of Conte, but he's even lower win percentage than Maurizio Sarri and obviously Thomas Tuchel as well. He just surpasses Graham Potter really in the recent permanent hires at Chelsea. So it's kind of hard to know, has he just made some terrible choices with regards to the clubs that he's taken? As you say, he went in eyes wide open about what the Chelsea situation was going to be, but it does feel, if you accept, and to be fair, maybe it's a bit harsh to say that, you know, you can remove the Tottenham aspect from his career and say his career hasn't been great. Well, he had a great stint at Tottenham, but everything after that, you'd have to say,
yeah, and he got the Tottenham job off the back of a really good job at Southampton. Yeah. He's made bad decisions in that few people have been able to make a success at Paris Saint-Germain, and it did feel different to Graham Potter. Like, I would have felt at the time Graham Potter did the right thing going to Chelsea, that he was a manager of a level who was unlikely to get too many opportunities and you go and you back yourself. Whereas Pochettino was operating in that nice little circle at the very top, whereas if he didn't take the Chelsea job, he would have got one of the other top 15 jobs in Europe. And it, when you look at it now, it does feel as though Chelsea is probably the worst of those jobs. And also, even if he was to stay on for next season, you know, everything we've read about their financial situation is that they're completely hamstrung in terms of what they'll be able to do over the course of the summer in terms of buying players, may have to sell Conor Gallagher, one of their best players. Not been helped, as have any of the same with Graham Potter. The fact that Reece James and Ben Chilwell just are never fit together. Like, you know, Reece James up there as one of the best right backs, certainly in the Premier League, if he gets a run of games, but that hasn't happened in so long. And he may well have been thinking, I'd base my entire team and system around the full backs, and, you know, not having them fit. Like, you look at Cucurella, geez, what a disappointment Cucurella has been as well. You know, just complete shambles. 50 million quid, gone. So I don't think it's the case that anyone's given him a free pass necessarily. I think it's just a general shrug of the shoulders with Chelsea.
Definitely feels that way. Brian's been in touch to say Odegaard player of the year by a mile, outstanding player, and RKS says Martin Odegaard by far the player of the season and the best Arsenal player. We'll be getting Lars Iverson's take on Odegaard in just a few minutes. Dylan meanwhile says Chelsea are dirt, but they could have and should have scored two or three in the first half. Arsenal still look a bit shaky at the back. You're putting your hopes in Nicholas Jackson, who is not exactly being prolific.
How are Arsenal shaky at the back? How many clean sheets have they kept in their last seven or eight games?
Yeah, they've got the best defence in the Premier League this season. But to be fair, Chelsea did create a few openings in that first half. And they were good chances.
Yeah, chances.
Hmm?
You know, you're not going to restrict teams to zero chances in a game.
No, but there has been a bit more of a chaos about Arsenal over the last few weeks. It's kind of felt like ever since they kicked off against Bayern Munich, It's kind of felt like there's just been a different nature to Arsenal compared to, say, how they approached the game at the Etihad. I know that's Manchester City, but there was an element of control that they've kind of dialed down a bit in recent weeks. And look, it's led to relatively good things happening, but I mean, Aston Villa did expose them as well, obviously, last Sunday week. A couple of other things we want to get to before we turn back to the football. On the golf front, Nathan, we had a story yesterday in The Guardian that Rory McIlroy is going to be, well, he's hoping to get back into the PGA board, which is an interesting move at this point in his career.
It sure is, considering the way he spoke was he couldn't have been happier to be out of there. I think everybody questioned the amount of time he invested into the policy board. It was from day one when he got involved, it would seem quite unusual at the time that the best player in the world would even be a player rep, that, you know, you have other things to be doing, and it was for more a journeyman type figure. Now that's changed dramatically because of the importance of the policy board. But he obviously, because of that, became the front man for the PGA Tour in the battle against LIV, against the PIF, seemed to relish it for quite a while, seemed more than happy to go to war with Greg Norman. But ultimately it felt as though he lost. Firstly, that the PGA Tour went behind his back and, you know, agreed this framework with the PIF and LIV, which nothing has really come of since. And that because of that betrayal of sorts, that he decided to step away, and then felt, you know, any amount of press conferences, it was nothing to do with me anymore. Glad to be out of there, you know. So for him to suddenly reverse gear and I'm going back in again, maybe shows that he's unhappy with how things are potentially going. So since then, we've seen a slow and steady move away from I hate LIV to, when we spoke to him at the Irish Open, the world has made up its mind for me when it comes to Saudi investment, that every other business is involved with the PIF. So if they're going to invest money, we should work with them to make sure it goes in the best possible way for the game of golf, to steadily feeling that actually, you know, we need, the best thing is we need now to go with the PIF if we're to have a world tour. So he started in the last couple of months talking a lot about a world golf tour, which would be basically half the events would be in America, and then you'd have something you've never had before, which is all the best players traveling around the world to, say, one year it might be an Irish Open, and the next year it'd be the French Open, and there'd be a Hong Kong Open, an Australian Open, and you would get everybody. You'd get the top 60, 70 in the world. You'd have huge prize funds. But the only way that would ever happen is if the Saudis are paying for it, because, you know, there's no financial system in Ireland that would ever allow you to have a tournament worth 25, 30 million pounds. There's not the sponsors there for that. You know, you look at the sponsorship of and the prize funds for the Irish Open over the last few years. So he's pushing towards that and seems to think that's the real opportunity of working with the PIF, that you'll get more of a world tour and move it away from America a little bit more, and that will be seen as growing the game, which they all love to use. Whereas since he's left, Patrick Cantlay has become a lot more powerful on the player board. Jordan Spieth is quite powerful, and the sense is that they don't feel that they need to go into business with the PIF, that actually the strategic sports group, led obviously by FSG, the Liverpool owners, and that their investment of a few billion a couple of months ago, that they can get more from them, they can get other American investors, and basically that the PGA Tour can be owned by American investors, can remain in America, can continue to increase prize funds. And that seems to be where the divide is. So whether Rory's going back in to sort of reopen negotiations with PIF, they had the first meeting about a month ago down the Bahamas, where Yasser Al-Rumayyan, who is the head of PIF and obviously of Newcastle as well, met with Tiger Woods, who's now the main player representative, which I don't think anyone could have foreseen. So, yeah, it's definitely a surprise. You sort of thought when Rory was gone, he was just going to concentrate in his own game from now on, leave the politics of the sport to other people. But I think he's so interested in it, and I think he just can't help himself. Like, he wants to have, you know, he's too important a figure not to have any power when every other important figure is in that room, and he's now on the outside and just going to have to take whatever happens. And his future in his next 10, 20 years playing golf is going to be decided by Patrick Cantlay.
The beef is real, but also two of the most important figures in world golf, it turns out.
Well, I say the most important figures in golf. Scottie Scheffler is generally not in that room at the moment.
Doesn't need to be, really.
Doesn't need to be. Yeah, we're going through an incredible spell on the course at the moment, where you have Nelly Korda winning five tournaments in a row, including the first major of the year at the weekend. And you have Scottie Scheffler winning four of the last five tournaments. Scottie Scheffler has twice as many wins this season as rounds of even par. Okay, so he has four wins. He has two even par rounds, and he doesn't have a single round over par all season. Like, this is the best spell of golf we have seen since Tiger Woods. There is no question about it. Now, whether he goes on to be, you know, greater than Rory and Brooks and Spieth in terms of majors, you know, he may well do it this year, the way he's playing. But we thought this should have happened last year. Like, he played this quality of golf last year, and he couldn't putt. And it, you know, it's probably cost him a major, if not more. But what he's doing to turn up the week after Augusta to Hilton Head, which is a totally different golf course, knowing that, you know, he's about to have a child, might have to go at any stage. And as he said himself, just sort of rocked up, unprepared, has a double bogey on early on Thursday, and sort of effortlessly just beats everybody by five shots, is fairly frightening for anybody who's trying to contend with him.
He's absolutely amazing. He's playing the Zurich Classic this week, is he?
Or Scotty.
Is he? Or is he?
I'd be surprised. Zurich Classic's a team event.
Oh,
so
okay.
One to get behind. Shane Lowry and Rory McIlroy are playing together.
Right.
Which Rory never plays this. It's never been the biggest event, the Zurich Classic of New Orleans, because, again, golfers, they're all for change and growing the game, but anything that's not just straight 72-hole stroke play, they're also never particularly excited about. So Rory and Shane, I assume this was, I don't know if you read Paul Kimmage's article with them previously, where they flew back after the Ryder Cup and went over to Luke Donald's house for a boozy lunch, and then Michael Jordan turned up, and the four of them had a very, very boozy lunch. There was many, many bottles of expensive wine, and I think during that boozy lunch, Shane and Rory said, let's play the Zurich Classic in New Orleans, and here they are.
Always do sober what you say you'll do drunk.
Exactly.
It's a good
exactly.
motto to live by. So keep an eye on that this weekend. It's 5 minutes past 8. You're with us here on Off the Ball Breakfast.